Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is a good day here on Faith and Family. We have a great conversation ahead of us. Perhaps you've heard of the recent case of Cassandra C. in Connecticut, a teen who was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma but refused treatment, and how the state became involved in that. And so Cassandra is in the custody of the state, and so the state became involved in her issue. And so we're going to talk about adolescent brain development and autonomy today. When do we become autonomous? Is there a marker of that? Is there an indicator of autonomy? So we're going to get to that with our expert today, and that's Dr. Jane Anderson. We're going to get to that conversation in just a moment. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University Wisconsin, for supporting our program. You can find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section there. Joining us by phone today, and to help us better understand adolescent brain development, we welcome our guest from the American College of Pediatricians, Dr. Jane Anderson, clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Anderson, thanks so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
Oh, Andy, thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, the whole adolescent brain is a mystery to many of us, and I'm looking forward to our conversation today. Having a child myself, he's not in those adolescent years yet, but preparing for those adolescent years, and we rely greatly on our pediatrician in our family. So I'm looking forward to our conversation today, helping us understand the development when it comes to children in general, and especially when it comes to adolescence and this whole autonomy situation. I was just talking about the Cassandra C. situation in Connecticut. When she refused treatment, the state intervened, took custody of Cassandra, and continued with administering the chemotherapy while she was being confined to a guarded hospital, and has only very little contact with her mom. Only twice a week is she allowed to talk with her mom, to visit with her mom. And I think the most interesting thing is that her attorney told Fox Connecticut the state shouldn't be able to substitute its judgment for her judgment as long as she is mature enough to understand what's going on and to make a reasonable decision, and we think she is. And that right there is a statement about autonomy. When do we become autonomous? So that question remains for me. When do we become mature enough to be autonomous? That's our whole conversation isn't necessarily about the Cassandra case here, but when do we become autonomous? Now, tell us a little bit about your background and your involvement. Well, first of all, what led you to your interest to a vocation in pediatrics?
Oh, well, that goes, I'd almost say hundreds of years, because I'm so old these days. But actually, when I was 10 years old, I was listening to a radio broadcast. It was one of the few Christian radio broadcasts at that time. And it was, I don't know if any of your listeners would ever remember back to the Bible broadcasting, was, and Danny Orlis was a program for children. And one of the children on the program got sick and had to go to their pediatrician. And I knelt beside my bed at 10 years of age and I said, God, if you want me to be a pediatrician, that's what I'll do for you. And so it goes way back.
So at 10 years old, you had this this inclination and desire to become a pediatrician. And tell us about the path that brought you to where you are today. It's quite an interesting journey. I've enjoyed reading about your education, your work, and certainly all your experience and your service today. Tell us about those years as you were studying to become a pediatrician. What was interesting along the way?
Well, I suppose the first thing was that God led me and a fairly dramatic way to Biola University. I didn't want to go to a Christian school because I didn't know if I could get into medical school from a Christian college. So I sort of told God, well, I'll go wherever you give me the most money. Well, that was Biola because my parents couldn't afford college for me. And I stayed at Biola praying that God would get me into medical school, just trusting him. And I was the first student from Biola to actually go to medical school, so it was a long time ago. They have had many students go on to much more high academic achievement than I have since then. But I then went off to UCLA for medical school and was really bombarded for my faith, criticized by my lab partners, etc. But I also met my husband the first day of medical school, so that was that was sweet. The Lord has a great sense of humor, you know. When I received my letter of acceptance to medical school, I actually cried tears of sadness, not joy, because at that time, again, so long ago, I felt that if I were a Christian and a woman and a physician, then I couldn't be a wife and mother. And so I felt that God was asking me to give up the dreams of a family, a husband and a family. And like I said, what a great sense of humor. I met the man who was going to be my husband the first day of medical school, and we were married 5 years later, and we have 4 biological children and 1 daughter who came into our home sort of foster adopt. So we're very, very blessed. And since that time, my husband and I have served in the Bay Area. He's a urologist. I, as you know, was a pediatrician. And our family committed ourselves to mission work. When the children were little, we supported missionaries, brought them into our home when they were on furlough to have a worldview that was mission-minded. And then starting about 15 years ago, we took our children on medical mission trips and have continued to do that every year, except now the children are grown and they have their own children, so we, my husband and I go by ourselves.
Well, that is quite a story, and obviously you're very dedicated and passionate about the vocation to which you've been given. And where does development, child development, adolescent development, where does that fit into this vocation, this career as a pediatrician? Quite often, I think in mainstream America, when we think of pediatrician, any kind of physician, we think strictly medicine, and we don't necessarily think about development as being a part of what physicians study and focus on. Being a parent now, I've seen how helpful it is, how helpful our pediatrician has been in that. But why is development such an important part of what you do, what you studied and what you do as a pediatrician?
Oh my goodness, Andy, it's my life. from the time a child is conceived until, we're always parents even when the children are adults. life is development, right? I mean, it's a biblical concept even. I mean, we're developing in our life in Christ. It's just a constant growth. And so it's been exciting for me to see how well-done scientific research will always support biblical concepts, because God's word is truth. And so any science that is research that's well done, and there are always poorly done studies, but well done research will always support biblical truth. And that's really why the American College of Pediatricians exists, is because other scientific organizations have twisted science or have molded it to fit their worldview and not taking it at its face value. And so it's exciting for me to be able to teach parents and show them biblical truths without having to quote the Bible to them in my practice, because I can show them children need their parents. And so many parents today want to be their child's friend rather than the authority figure in their life. And that's not biblical, and it's not healthy for families, and unfortunately it's not healthy for societies, and we're seeing that today. So development, from conception and for me up through 18 or 19 is when I see the children. It is an entire process of development. They're not just their bodies physically, but especially their minds. And we are learning so much more about brain development. You know, it wasn't but maybe 10 or 15 years ago that scientists, neurologists really believed that the brain had reached its total size that it was going to be by the time the child was 6 years old. And so therefore, you know, most brain development had happened by that time. And we knew that things progressed after that, but, you know, we didn't think many changes happened. And now we know that the entire brain is continuing to mold and shape and develop until really not fully mature until 25. And we know we keep learning after that, but the teenage brain is totally undeveloped. and especially undeveloped in the frontal lobe. It's the frontal lobe, the front part of the brain, that's sort of the CEO of the brain, the area of the brain that can strategize and make judgments and helps us develop our morals and our ethics and helps us strategize towards goal development and organize. Everything about sort of who we are and how we think ends up coming from the front part of the brain. And that's the part that's one of the last to mature, you know, 23 to 24 to 25.
That's interesting that 23, 24, 25, that's when it really, it sounds like it all starts to come together.
And, you know, Shakespeare knew this. This is such a hoot. You know, Shakespeare said, I wish there were no age between 10 and 23, for there is nothing in between but getting wenches with child. And he said wronging the ancient tree, in other words, hurting our, you know, adults, stealing and fighting. He said the adolescent brain was boiled. I mean, he knew this back in the 1500s. Aristotle knew it. He said the same thing. And the funny thing is the car rental companies, they've known for years, don't rent to a person less than age 24, right? So we've known this experientially, and now sort of science is catching up because people have been able to do sequential brain imaging scans, MRIs, on teenagers and followed them over time and watched to see which parts of the brains were changing. And it turns out every area of the adolescent brain is immature.
So, and this has been, as you said, just through imaging, we've been able to learn this.
Yes.
Well, you're right about the car rental thing. I remember back in college and even grad school, I was a young student, younger than most students in grad school, and in trying to rent a car, I always had to pay an additional fee under the age of 25. I thought it was just age discrimination, but I suppose now there's evidence.
Brain discrimination.
So up until 25, there's really all this development happening that is key. Let's take a look at this development. Help us understand brain development. And do we see early signs that are leading toward autonomy in certain stages of development or childhood?
Sure. So that's that brings us back to Cassandra's case. And first, I just want to make sure that I say publicly what a tragedy this is, mm-hmm. and how, you know, my heart and everybody's heart goes out to Cassandra and her family, because none of us would want to ever be in that situation, and we grieve with them because it seems like no decision or outcome is really going to bring a lot of comfort or happiness. My heart just goes out to the family. Mm-hmm. But my guiding principles are that parents normally should be those who are responsible for their children, so I don't like the idea of the state coming in. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of parents, as God said, to be responsible for their children's health and medical decisions and education, mm-hmm. and religious upbringing. And I value life as a gift from God, and life isn't always easy, and God asks us to struggle so we can grow and develop. And I just wish Cassandra's mom had sort of valued life too with her and helped her to make a decision that would have really, Hodgkin's lymphoma is curable, and she could have a lovely life. I hope that happens for her. Anyway, adolescent and brain development and how it happens with autonomy. Well, you know, we talk about even giving choices to little toddlers. Mm-hmm. So for little toddlers, 18 months to 2 years of old, 2 years of age, they're trying to figure out who they are. They're developing their sense, you know this well, their sense of who I am, and they're trying to figure out, hey, I'm different from mom and dad, and I can say no, that proves I'm different. And so one of the things we tell parents of toddlers is, don't say, do you want some ice cream? Because the little one is going to say no, just to prove they're different. But you put the ice cream away and then they burst into tears. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's going on? You have to give them choice and say, do you want vanilla or chocolate? And maybe I shouldn't be using ice cream as the best example. But
oh, it's a winner in our house, that's for sure.
But not the healthiest choice, I guess. But anyway, you know, do you want a cheese sandwich or a turkey sandwich? And you give them a choice, mm-hmm. and then they can show you their sense of autonomy and that they're developing a sense of who I am as an individual, you know, without having to say no and have a temper tantrum over it. So that's an example of, yes, they're developing a sense of choice and a sense of autonomy and a sense of who I am, but does that mean that little one can make an appropriate medical decision that has long-term consequences? No. Mm-hmm. And you follow that on out and you get to a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old, and you know, our society is very schizophrenic. Very schizophrenic. We are taking 12, 13, 14-year-olds and allowing them to make medical decisions for confidential information situations like sexuality and abortions and birth control pills, while at the same time, we know that their brains are not fully developed. And so the lawyers will argue on one hand that these teens, preteens, early teens, can make competent medical decisions, but in the Supreme Court decision about whether a 17 or 18-year-old should suffer the death penalty, no, their brains aren't competent to make good decisions. So we're very schizophrenic in how we approach this. But science mm-hmm. comes down on the side of saying adolescents' brains are not yet developed. And particularly, there's several things going on for the adolescent. There's an area of the brain in the center of the brain called the amygdala, and it's our emotion center. And that emotion center is on sort of high alert during the teen years. Oh, I don't have to tell any parents have seen that. And they're going to have a much more vigorous emotional response to situations. That's one thing. And the other thing is they actually interpret people's emotions differently. And so they, when they've been asked to view like videotapes or pictures of people in different emotional states, they misinterpret it. Mm-hmm. So can you just imagine the teenager coming home, the teacher said, you know, the teacher had said to them at school, oh, you know, Susie, you didn't turn in your homework today. And really the teacher's trying to say, oh, I'm concerned because usually you do turn in your homework. And the teen comes home and says, my teacher was so mad at me today, you know, because I didn't turn in my homework, because they misinterpret those emotions because the amygdala is not well connected to that frontal lobe. So that frontal lobe that helps them figure out complicated situations and, you know, strategize and what's going on, it isn't connected. So there's nothing, there's no relationship between their emotions and sort of their knowledge base. And so that's a huge problem. The other problem that teenagers have is that their hippocampus, which is an area of the brain that has to do with memory, is also not well connected to the frontal lobe. So it's really difficult for them to sort of coordinate their thought processes between past memories, knowledge, emotions. And then you can see how that would make it so difficult to be able to plan and make a competent medical decision for the future.
Hmm. So just going back to how we interpret and perceive the world around us during those adolescent years, those, as you said, those early teenage years, that how we perceive the world around us, how we interpret communication, body language, all those things, because we're so heightened and, in a sense, sensitive, we perceive things in a way that they're really not intended. And think about, yeah, as you pointed out, trying to make life decisions at that point, how dangerous that can be, how important it is for parents to be involved in decisions.
It's crucial. Parental involvement is crucial. I testified in the state of Alaska in support of their parental notification law and brought to them evidence that many of the articles document the benefit of parental involvement in teenagers. You know, the teenagers come home and say, or not come home, but they go to someone and go, my parents would kill me if they found out that I'm, you know, pregnant or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the vast majority of parents rise to the occasion, and they're there to support their teenagers. And if you look at what's required for a teenager, for anybody, to make a competent medical decision, oh my goodness, the lawyers lay out a huge list of what has to be experienced by the person. They have to be able to reason about hypothetical probabilities. They have to be able to prioritize abstract variables. Even as I'm saying this to you, it's like, oh, really? It sounds so ridiculous. They have to be able to take a future time perspective. They have to be able to incorporate their cultural and religious values and take into account their emotional state. It's like, really, can any of us make a competent medical decision? And certainly not an adolescent who has, you know, all this immaturity in their lobes of their brain. They need, I tell parents, they sort of need to be the every lobe of the parent of the kid's brain. The parent needs to be there to support them.
So starting with the what was the first lobe that we talked about in the frontal lobe,
the main sort of, when people talk about sort of the CEO, the judgment center of the brain, that's the frontal lobe, and it is sort of what's behind your forehead, you know, the very front part of your brain.
And that's for processing what again now?
Oh, everything. Your memory, impulse control, learning, judgment, strategizing, planning, problem solving, being goal directed, your moral intelligence, your abstract reasoning, your ability to organize and plan, sort of everything. And it's also involved in impulse control. And so there you can see if why you might have more impulsive behaviors as a teenager, because the impulse control mechanism isn't mature yet.
Very interesting. So, and then moving on to the next, there was another part that you'd mentioned.
I mentioned the amygdala, the emotion center of the brain.
Right.
And the amygdala is very interesting because, again, we're learning so much about it. Let me interject that I'm very worried about social media and all the screen time, particularly for teens. We develop our sense of empathy and compassion by looking at another person and seeing the expression on their face. And there's an area of the brain sort of related to the amygdala, but it's called the mirror neurons, mirror like you look in the mirror in the morning when you're shaving or whatever. Mirror neurons allow us to experience the emotional experience of another person. So if I'm looking at somebody and they fall down and hurt their elbow and they're in excruciating pain, literally the neurons in my brain that say pain in your elbow will start firing. In other words, my brain will experience what you're experiencing. And that's where empathy and compassion comes from. But if you're not seeing that in another person because you're all on Facebook or whatever, you don't develop those mirror neurons. And there was a study that came out of UCLA just recently, November, December of last year. And what they did was they took sixth graders who were going to be going to a science camp just for 5 days. And half the class went to the science camp for 5 days and half the class served as the control. The sixth graders who went to the science camp for 5 days were not allowed to have their cell phones or screen time at science camp. Before the camp and after the camp, the students took tests of how they looked at and evaluated the emotions of another person, both in picture and in video. And the control students did it too. And what they found was just 5 days without social media, these 12 and 13-year-olds were better able to correctly identify people's emotions after 5 days without screen time. And so,
wow.
Yes, it's powerful. And so, see, all these different things are involved with how this teenage brain is developing. And so, as parents and as physicians who are encouraging parents, parents just have to be involved in their teenagers' lives. They have to be able to be the authority figure, set limits. No, you aren't going to have a computer in your bedroom because that leads to obesity and poorer grades and more sexual involvement and all sorts of things that happen if the kid has a computer in their bedroom. amazing, something simple like that. But setting that kind of limit, a lot of families say, I'm not going to go there. Just let them have it. I don't want that kind of controversy, and they give up their authority.
Hmm. I want to talk more about parent involvement and the parent's role in child development, adolescent development. We need to take a quick break. When we come back from that break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Jane Anderson, clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and also a member of the American College of Pediatricians. Hope you can stick around for more Faith and Family right after this, right here on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration and action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
With Valentine's Day approaching, love's in the air. And during this special week of broadcasts focused on love, I want to take you back shortly after Life Issues Institute began. In the early 90s, we were looking for a way to touch the hearts of undecided Americans on abortion. We did polling to see how they viewed the pro-lifers, and it wasn't pretty. So we invited all the major pro-life, pro-family groups to Washington, D.C. for three meetings. We shared our polling, analyzed its meaning, and brainstormed on how we could reach the undecided people. The result was the phrase, love them both, and it proved very effective. The key was letting Americans know we love both the mother and child, and we want to protect the rights of both. Love often says it all.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, reliable and trustworthy. KFUO, your pioneer of Christian radio, AM 850 and KFUO.org. The message is clear.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Today we are talking with Dr. Jane Anderson, clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, also a member of the American College of Pediatricians. Today we're talking about adolescent brain development and autonomy. And before we went to break, Dr. Anderson, we were talking about some of the things that come up, some of the challenges that we face is as adolescents when it comes to brain development, the things, decisions that are difficult to make, and why it's important for parents to be parents and to be involved. Specifically, what role do parents play in these stages of development for adolescents?
Well, as we mentioned, literally parents have to be their child's brain. And a lot of times parents think that, if I've done a good job, or even if I haven't done a good job, there's nothing I can do during an adolescent years. But literally, Peter Jensen, who's director of children's mental health at Columbia University, said parents have to function like a surrogate set of frontal lobes, an auxiliary problem solver. I mean, they just have to be there because the kids can't do it by themselves. Parents can help teens in so many ways. Think about all those things we talked about that the frontal lobe does, the strategizing, the problem solving, the planning.
Mm-hmm.
A teen can easily get frustrated with a huge task that's presented to them, a big homework project or something. A parent can simply say, "Hey, let's break it down into smaller tasks." I'm not there saying the parent should do the homework for the child, never,
mm-hmm.
but to help them break it down, to help them problem solve, maybe to give them a graphic, way to organize it. That's helpful. For a parent to share real-life situations with the teen, here's what happened when I was a teenager, to let the teenager experience real-life situations, to ask them questions as they're evaluating, career choices or something, what little thing can you do now that'll help you for later on? All sorts of things. I think one of the important things for parents is you can see consequences. The teens can't see consequences. Mm-hmm. So you can say, well, I'm sort of afraid if you make that choice, this might happen. But then if it happens, don't rescue the teen. You know, a lot of times you just got to let them suffer the consequences of what they've done.
Mm.
You know, we used to tell our kids, you know, if you get in trouble and you get arrested, you know, count it, you're going to spend the night in jail. I mean, fortunately, we didn't ever have to do that with our kids, but they knew we're not going to come rescue them. You know, they're going to be stuck there. You know, our society sort of says, don't convey your values to your teens. You know, it's just going to turn them off. And, you know, the research is absolutely the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
The research says that if a parent one time, just one time, says to a teenager, I don't approve of marijuana speaking, they are seven times less likely to smoke marijuana. I mean, it's just amazing. Teens are listening to parents. So I would say to parents, please convey your values. And that goes for, you know, alcohol, marijuana, sexual activity. The teens are listening. And the other thing is, be there for them as far as teaching impulse control early in childhood. You know, we sort of think, oh, well, little toddlers are impulsive and what can we do? But, you know, there are teaching tools. There's, you know, time out. There are different ways that you can show a little toddler, no, you can't, you know, do everything you want to do. And you start early so that they have some foundation for when it's going to be harder to have impulse control later on. Having them have enough sleep. Oh, my goodness. Teenagers don't get enough sleep, and so they're not going to have as great behavior if they're not sleeping. And then there's great studies for parents limiting access to dangerous situations and monitoring everything. There are great studies out of Columbia University. It's called the Center on Alcohol and Substance Abuse, and every year they put out documents on family life, and they were one of the first to show that teens who eat more dinners and more meals with their families are less likely to participate in any high-risk behavior. Teens who eat dinner with their families eat more healthy meals. They have a better relationship with their parents. They have better relationship with their siblings. They actually do better in school. They have better emotional health. A study just came out in December showing that teens who eat with their families are less susceptible to the negative influence of bullying in school. It's the protective value of family meals is just amazing. And so try to eat meals together as often as the family can. And then, you know, volunteering is a powerful, powerful thing for parents to do with their teenagers. Oh, my goodness. Volunteering says, my life is important because I'm helping someone else. And teens want a sense of purpose in their lives, but it also bonds the family together. And it says we can work together as a family to accomplish something. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to volunteer as family now. I mean, we did it prior to going overseas. We volunteered in our community, but going overseas, oh my goodness, it's just a very powerful situation. And then another thing that parents can do, you know, teens, we haven't talked about risk-taking in teens yet, but teenagers' dopamine, the pleasure reward center, is also immature. And the dopamine levels, the hormone that says I'm feeling good, those levels are actually higher in teenagers. And that's sort of good, but it means they have to have something really stimulating and really exciting to make them feel excited. And unfortunately, in our society, so many of the sort of risky situations, they've been taken away from kids. You know, the 13-year-old can't go drive the tractor on grandpa's farm type of thing. And so some of what used to be risky in the olden days, it isn't available to our teens now. So parents need to find sort of healthy risky behaviors for the teens to do.
Mm-hmm.
I call them shared risk experiences. And you can start when they're younger, you know, 5, 6, 7, you know, and the parents can, it's usually an outdoor activity. But, you know, if we've been through a scary experience together, we are bonded together.
Yeah.
We are connected together. Mm-hmm. And the teens who are most connected to their families are going to survive and navigate the teenage years the best. So parents want to be doing things. What can we do to connect together? We volunteer together. We have shared risk experiences. Go hiking, and when the snake slithers across your path, parents can egg it on going, oh, my goodness, that was so scary, but we all survived. And and then when you go camping and the rain washes your tent down, you know, it's like, oh, but we can work together, and yeah, it was awful. And, you know, we went, oh, my goodness, we went through lava tubes, and I was crawling on my, you know, stomach thinking, you know, I was totally thought I was going to suffocate, and I had to keep thinking, we're building memories, we're staying connected, we're building memories. Meanwhile, I just wanted to die. But things that parents, it's usually outdoor activities, you know, mm-hmm. where you can have these shared risk experiences where you can say, wow, we survived that together as a family. Those kids, those teenagers, are going to get their adrenaline high under that parental, you know, supervision.
You mentioned volunteering and these adventure or even you know, managed risk activities. In earlier, you talked about communicating your values to your teens, and that it sounds to me that all of those scenarios that you just described, whether it's volunteering or the adventure or the managed risk taking, that all of those are ways of modeling those values.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you know, we hear, you know, that they're going to, you know, values are, you know, caught, not taught.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's both.
Sure.
And the teenagers are listening. And when you survey teenagers, they'll say they're listening to their parents. And when you ask them whose input do they value, they'll list their parents. But our society, unfortunately, adolescent medicine pediatricians are the worst, most of them, because they totally undermine the child-parental relationship by, as soon as the 12, 13, 14-year-old walks in the office, we as pediatricians are supposed to separate them from their parent. That's absolutely the wrong thing and the wrong message to be conveying mm-hmm. to them.
What about peers? We've talked about how parents are important in development. What role do peers play in adolescent development and adolescent brain development?
What a great question. And I have to tell you, I'm not aware of too much research that's been done on that. I mm-hmm. mean, as far as the brain development per se, I mean, we know if a teenager hangs out with other teens who are participating in risky behaviors, you know, they're going to do it too. And I think one of the nicest ways to monitor your children is to have their friends over and mm-hmm. volunteer to drive them places and listen to their, you know, you turn on the radio and they think you're listening to the news, but you're really listening to their conversations in
right.
the back seat and finding out what's going on. So I think, you know, being aware of your children's friends is so important, but I don't have a lot of actual sort of neurological basis
sure.
for saying that. What I can tell you, which is fascinating, is that they have studied parents and how the parent of one teen will affect that teenager's friend. So if a parent of one teen is involved and promoting healthy behaviors and conveying to their teen what we think is, you know, good health,
mm-hmm.
the teenager's friends are also protected and have less high-risk behavior because of that parent. So that should be a huge encouragement to parents out there. You're not just going to be influencing your children. You are going to be influencing your children's friends.
And that's pretty significant. And the other side of that to keep in mind is when your child is spending time with other families,
exactly.
What are the examples being set by the adults in those families?
Exactly. Yeah. And I, you know, people can say we might have been too suffocating or whatever, but our children could bring their friends over to our house. And very rarely did they go over to other kids' homes. We made our home appealing, and we'd have parties and food and, you know, whatever else. But we didn't let our kids spend the night with other people because even people in the church, you don't know what's going on in their home. You don't know what programs they're watching on TV or what music they're listening to. And Yeah, there's an entity called Hands On Parenting. Again, the Columbia Center did this study, but parents who monitored everything parents who monitored their teens' TV and internet decreased the risk of drug abuse by half. Parents who knew where their teen was after school decreased the risk by half. And I mentioned the information about marijuana. Monitoring everything is so important. And it doesn't mean you're nasty about it. It just means you're aware.
Sure.
And then you help your teen make good decisions. I mean, I'll confess, we were talking to our son one time. He was a teenager. And my husband was talking to him and found sort of, inappropriate material stuck under the bed. And it's like brought it out and sort of said, how appropriate is this? And he had spent his money for this video game, and we didn't think it was appropriate, and, you know, he had to throw it out. And maybe people say, oh, that's, you know, so ridiculous. No, it sends a very vivid message to a teenager. That's not acceptable in our house. When you're living in our house, it's not acceptable. And here, let's talk about why. You know, what message is that teaching you? So I just say monitor everything.
Well, you've brought up some things, a few things that can affect development, that maybe hinders development, or the problem that are problematic along the way. You know, we've talked about, you've mentioned alcohol and drugs and things. Are there specifically, you know, is there clear evidence of things that delay development and autonomy?
Oh, my goodness. So this, I wish I could tell every parent, I wish I could tell every lawmaker. There is such amazing evidence of what marijuana and alcohol both do to the brain. So that hippocampus area that we were mentioning before, that's the area where the memories are formed.
Mm-hmm.
That is specifically targeted by alcohol. And what we know now is that a teenager who starts drinking at a younger age is much more likely to become addicted than a teenager who starts drinking, you know, at an older age, 18, 19, 20. The other thing we know is that binge drinking damages those memory-forming cells in the hippocampus much worse, or it damages them more than you know, drinking a small amount. And what are teenagers likely to do but binge drink?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is it totally changes the entire formation of the hippocampus. And so that child or teenager's ability to remember and learn is affected for the rest of his or her life.
Wow.
This is long-term damage that's being done to that hippocampus that will never be able to be corrected. And because a teenager who drinks is so much more likely to become addicted, I mean, it's like, please, don't even take one drink. Don't even start. And I know people think that that's, you know, ridiculous to ask of them. But to tell them how serious and how dangerous it is, they're not getting that message from us. And especially now with this promotion to legalize marijuana, they're not getting that. We have evidence. A study came out of New Zealand. This is so sad. So a study came out of New Zealand of 1,000 people followed for 20 years, period of time of 20 years. Those who started using marijuana heavily in their teenage years had a drop in IQ of 8 to 10 points between the age of 13 and 38. So they're dropping IQ points.
Wow.
Those who started using marijuana after they were 18 years of age, they did show a decrease in IQ points, but not to the extent that the younger teen did when they started. And then those who didn't use marijuana had no change in their IQ points. So we have dramatic evidence. There are many dangers to marijuana, but we have in one area of just learning and memory, don't use it.
It sounds like it's certainly a not only a hinder, but sends things in the wrong direction, the opposite direction,
sure,
in terms of development. Well, what are things then that, what are ways to promote healthy development? What are practical tips? We've talked already a little bit about it, helping teens make, well, even children and teens make decisions by giving them, especially with the young child, giving them choices, and you know, that instead of, do you want ice cream, do you want do you want chocolate or vanilla, to help them make those choices, those insignificant choices in earlier in the early years, help them make more significant choices later on in life. Are there other practical tips or other ways that that we as parents can help promote healthy development and that leads to autonomy for adolescents or for young adults?
It's a great question, Andy, and I think every family is, you know, should spend some time thinking about that. There are lots of different ways, but I think you have to look at this as a step-by-step process. And so, it depends on your community. So, for instance, letting a child have some independence to walk or bike to school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the old days, everybody did that. You know, how else did you get to school? We happened to live very close to a freeway. We were afraid of, child abduction. And so that wasn't something we let our children do, but we might take them someplace else, like a Christian camp, where they could bike all over the place, mm-hmm. and have that same kind of independent experience. And so I think each family has to look and say, at this stage in my child's life, knowing what I know about them and their temperament, we have to take into account temperament, the shy child versus, the risk-taking child, what we know about their development, what we know about their environment, where we live, who our friends are, how can we allow them to have experiences that are going to help them form the basis for good decision-making later on? And we, this is just us, but we tried to make sure our teenagers, for instance, had experiences with other adults outside of our home, so that they were, given their little wings to fly, but they were still being supervised. So our daughter had an opportunity to go with a traveling soccer team, went from San Francisco to Atlanta, saw the Olympics when it was there, played soccer, and she thinks she's being so independent and grown up, but we had a teacher friend accompany her. Mommy didn't go with her, but her young teacher friend did. And so she was being well supervised. She didn't know it. And she felt like she was growing and maturing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those kind, and every family's going to find what feels comfortable to them and what, makes sense for their family. But I would say a gradual process, gradually giving them more responsibility, gradually giving them more privileges. And so another point, big point, is privileges don't come if you don't show yourself responsible. So I'm not sure that I would say, oh, sure, go take the car out when you can't, keep your room clean or whatever you want to link it to. You don't get a privilege without showing yourself responsible. So every, teen and family is going to do that differently.
So privileges come with are earned, and it's not just okay, you're 13 now, you can do whatever you want now that you're a teenager, which is which is an approach that is sometimes encouraged in our world and in our culture today, but rather it's something that happens, that responsibility is given gradually, that to take on those responsibilities and that freedom. That independence to do those things independently
and
comes
gradually. The states are picking that up as far as like teenage drivers.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be you would turn 16, you get your license, go drive the car. And now the states have found that if they do it as a gradual process, and each state's different, but you can drive, but you can drive with a parent or an adult in the car. You can drive by yourself, but you can't have friends with you in the car because they're going to distract you.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get to be older, now you're 18, you can drive by yourself. So the states have learned that, driving, that isn't just something that happens at 16. You make it a more gradual process and you have less accidents. So the states have learned that.
Sure.
We as parents need to incorporate it too.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to also include in our conversation, I know that you've traveled with some of your missions. In your travels around the world, have you noticed, and by visiting other cultures, when you look at the development of teens here in the U.S. and you look at development of teens, adolescents in other cultures, is it pretty similar? Is it pretty universal? Or do you see in some other cultures that there are some significant differences, whether it's advanced or delayed?
Oh, what a great question, Andy. And sort of depends on the area.
Mm-hmm.
And we spend a lot of our time doing medical work out in very rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think happens, and I can't prove this, okay? Don't anybody take me to the bank on this. But, I think our teenagers in America have a more difficult time navigating adolescence because they are getting such conflicted messages. So especially our Christian teens, they don't get a Christian worldview at school. And they're constantly in school, if they're going to a public school, they constantly have to be asking themselves, what is this teacher saying that I can accept? What is this teacher saying that I shouldn't accept? What's truth? And they're bombarded in school, mm-hmm. and in the culture, in the news, by things that, sometimes by sports figures, things that violate mm-hmm. our Christian biblical worldview. And they're having to navigate not just all these adolescent years, but also this cultural clash between their biblical worldview and what's happening in the world around them. Teenagers growing up in a rural village in Malawi are not bombarded with that kind of information. Their culture and their values are supported by the school and the church and their community. So they might still have all the same, emotional changes and brain changes and everything that a teenager has, but it's not as severe a reaction to their culture because they're not getting conflicted messages. And I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
Sure. No, certainly. Well, a child's educational experience, if it's in line with the values, if who's teaching your child shares and communicates the same values that you do, then that makes a huge difference and leaves them less conflicted during those, especially those important developmental years.
Yeah, certainly. So can you see I'm a big fan of schooling or homeschooling?
Sure, sure.
And I think that helps teenagers navigate this time better. There's also the teens in other countries certainly have access to alcohol everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and so that's a risk for teenagers sort of universally. And unfortunately, when we were in Malawi last year, marijuana was becoming a big issue there, which was so sad.
Well, we're running out of time, but now that you have grown children, was there an indicator for you when they were ready, when they were, development has gone well, they're autonomous? Was there a significant moment for you when you could see that?
No, not really. I mean, it was a process over time, mm-hmm. and for each child, it was clearly different. And don't get me wrong, there are some children who, teenagers who at 15 and 16 are able to do problem solving, they're able to strategize, they're able to look ahead. But even those teens that we think, oh, wow, this is a strong teen, they're problem solving right, they're thinking ahead, they're planning for their future. And I was planning for my future as a teenager. I was planning on college and medical school, and I didn't participate in some activities in high school because I knew where I wanted to be. And I know there are teens like that. But even so, to say that that teen is capable of making long-term decisions when emotions are involved and when they're struggling through all the adolescent issues, I think is a very difficult thing for a teenager to be able to do without good parental guidance and support.
Our guest today, Dr. Jane Anderson, clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, also a member of the American College of Pediatricians. You can find out more, you can read more information on the American College of Pediatricians website, bestforchildren.org. Great articles there and resources that I think I've found very helpful, bestforchildren.org. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to get to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.